What questions? I don't know. I mean, I'd be happy to talk about it if I knew what it was. No, mostly just people sharing experience, huh? And I'd be happy to share it with you, but I don't remember what they were. I'm about brain dead. You've been having me talking for a long time. Step 11 suggests prayer meditation. We shouldn't be shy on this matter of prayer. Better men than we are using it constantly. It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. It would be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions. Now, we're going to talk about the 11th step, and I don't believe that 5% of all the people in Alcoholics Anonymous do it. Right? Period. I think that people love to talk about prayer and meditation, but I don't believe that 5% of the people in this program actually follow the directions. And the question that's attached to that is, why would you settle for half a loaf? Okay? If this works, why not do it? You want to know why we don't want to do it? Because it takes discipline. And this step is about discipline. It says at the end of the description, it says, in this way God disciplines us. That means that there is a procedure that we have to engage in the 11th step, and it's probably as difficult to do. It isn't tough. But it means that there are things that we do in the morning and at night and through the day to keep ourselves on a spiritual plane. And it takes discipline to do that. So here's the description. Interestingly enough, it talks about when we... It doesn't start in the morning, it starts at night. Okay? It talks about when we retire at night. We constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? That's the first question. Now I want to show you something. People that do the work, see my book? Where the hell do you think all the pages are falling out? Right there. You know why? Because if you're going to do it, it's got so many instructions in it that if you're like me, you'll open that book to that page every night and read it off and answer the questions. Go look. Find people that do the work and then go look at their book. And their book looks like that. See here where all the pages are falling out of it? That's right on the 11th step. Just thought you'd like to know.
If my book doesn't look like yours, is it still going to be okay?
No. Thank you. Is it? My goodness. Did you really? Wow. Of course you were. Wow. Okay. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? So that's what I do, is I ask myself those questions at night. Do we owe an apology? Sometimes. Have we kept something to ourselves which should have been discussed with another person at once? You know what? Some of that stuff is about lying by omission. right? But it asks the question and answer it. You know, just sit there and answer it. You don't have to write it down, just answer it. Were we kind and loving towards all? Are you kidding? No, not every day, no. Sometimes I have a tendency to be a little short with people. What could we have done better? What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time? Just go through and answer the questions. Or were we thinking of what we could do for others, of what we could pack into the stream of life? Now, there is an inclination when you do this to go, oh, Jesus, you know, I just keep screwing this up. I mean, I am no saint. And I'm selfish, and I keep doing this stuff. And I don't know, I just don't seem to get it up. And then it says, but we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. That's what I just described. Worry, remorse, and morbid reflection. Okay, so if I'm sitting there and I'm going, well, I'm asking these questions and I'm still selfish and I'm still dishonest and I still am thinking of myself most of the time, and then I get mad at myself and then I worry about, well, I'm never going to get this. That's worry. And remorse is I don't know why I should be further than this. Morbid reflection is just, this is never going to work. And it says to avoid that. You know what? I'm doing the best I can. I truly am trying to do this. And if I'm trying to do this and I'm doing the best I can, that's the best I can do. And God understands that. Okay? And for me, just to say I can't get a handle on this stuff limits my usefulness to other people. After making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. God, what should I correct here? Show me how to change this. I think all prayers are answered. On awakening, just right when you wake up, okay? Let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. You can't consider them if you don't have any. Okay? Now, how are you going to come into the day right when you wake up and have a set of plans? That's right. So I write my to-do list the night before. Okay, my plans for the day. Now, let me show you what plan. I wish I would have brought my Palm Pilot with me, because that's where I put them. My plans for the day include a number of things about business. Like most days I'm working, so I have a list. I have an appointment at 9, and I want to do this. I'm going to take somebody out to lunch and all the rest of that. Okay, so I have plans for the day surrounding business. I also have plans for the day about what my intent is. One of the things that shows up every day, and the reason why I put it on a Palm Pilot is because I don't have to write it over again, I just don't erase it. Okay? Some of the things that I have on my list of things to do every day, the first one is be happy. Right? Whoa. What's that got to do with? Right? You want to know what that's got to do with? I don't know how to do that. I have to work at being happy. Isn't that a shame? We live difficult lives, and then all of a sudden we get intense, I guess is the best term. And so somebody will come up and ask you some really awful question like, what do you do for fun? I don't know. What do you do for fun? I don't know. Well, why the hell don't you find out? I'm looking around trying to find out what fun is. I know what some of it is. Other things that are on my plans for the day, make someone else's life better. Okay? That's on my plan every day. Make someone else's life better. So how do you do that? Help a drunk? Help a friend? Help a stranger? Just make sure that at some point today, you try and make someone else's life a little better. So things like that are on my to-do list. Love my children. Okay? They truly are the joy of my life. And I want them to know it. You know, I come from a seriously dysfunctional family. But no offense to them, but that's the way it turned out. And it's no big deal about who I am, except I have to come from a little further back to make things work sometimes. And yeah, I had a problem with role models. I really didn't know how to be a dad, and I never abused my children, but I probably didn't tell them that I loved them as much as I should have, the first ones. And so now I tell them all the time. I don't care if they're grown up. I make them hug me. Oh, Dad. You know. You know, come here. Do you know how much I love you? I love you more than life itself. I would jump in front of a bullet for any one of you. You are truly the joy of my life. You are bright, intelligent. You have the whole world in front of you. You have every opportunity to go out there and become the person you choose to be. You have every tool, and if you don't have it, I'll go find it. And I love you more than anything in my life. Okay? That's what I tell them. You know what? My parents never once ever told me they loved me. Neither one of them. And I'm walking around going, Jesus, I mean, what the hell kind of a person am I? And I don't want my kids to grow up like that. I don't tell them they're stupid. I don't tell them they're clumsy. I don't tell them anything like that. I tell them they're bright and they have a wonderful future. And that life is going to be great for them. And you know what? It's not a lie if they believe it. Someone said you create your own reality. That's to some real degree is true. And if kids grow up happy because they believe they're happy, they are happy. Okay? So that's what I do. And I want to make my kids' life really meaningful. And I'm in a business where I can mix my spiritual job and my temporal job. I work with inmates. And nobody's in there giving inmates hope. I got to tell you, once you get in the system, and I have that experience, once you get into the system, people will tell you you have no chance at all. And the truth is that 44%, at least in the state of Colorado, 44% of all of those people in the criminal justice system will never, ever, ever get out of it. 44%. And I go in there and tell them they can't. And nobody tells him that. And I go in and tell him, don't let your past determine your future. And just because you haven't done it doesn't mean you can't do it. I'm telling you the same thing. Don't let your past determine your future, and just because you haven't done it doesn't mean you can't do it. Okay? You have no idea what you can do. How the hell would you know? I didn't. Why don't you find out? So I have these plans for the day, and I got them all written out, and then some of them I get done and some of them I don't. If I do them, I erase them and I put some new ones in there, and then when I get up in the morning, I review them. Okay? And I go, okay, this is the plan. This probably doesn't work anymore, so I'm going to do this instead. And that's my plan for the day. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And I go off and I go through my day, and sometimes I get some of them done, sometimes I get all of them done, and sometimes I get none of them done. And you want to know that it doesn't make any difference. If I have a plan for the day, and most people get out of the morning and get out of bed in the morning and go, what the hell's going to happen today? Okay? I don't get up like that. I get up in the morning and look at it and go, this is what's going to happen today. And you have no idea what that does to your anxiety level. It brings it way down because you have a plan. Most people have no plan at all. Most people have no goals at all. I teach goal setting to inmates. I go, why the hell would I do that? I'm in an institution. And when it's good practice for when you get out. Start thinking about it. What do you want your house to look like? What do you want your family to look like? What do you want your spiritual life to look like? What do you want your career to look like? What do you want your financial condition to look like? Start them thinking. You get an institution, everybody tells you you're going to be there for the rest of your life, even if you aren't. Everybody treats you like you're some kind of a pariah, and you have no skills, and you have no future, and you have nothing going for you. And you want to know something? It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy for an awful lot of people. And I'm not up for it. So I go in there and tell them, that's a lie. Don't believe lies. I'm telling you that no matter where you've been or what you've done or what they've been telling you, you have a future if you choose to. And the thing that's going to make the biggest difference about your ability to operate in this world is the 6 inches between your ears. And if you believe you can, you can. And if you don't, you're screwed. Period. Same thing. I mean, you don't have to be an inmate. Go there. Okay. So we go through our plans for the day, and then we launch out. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Why? This just turning inward, okay? So we say, God, get this stuff out of the way in the beginning, all right? So I can get on with it here. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance, for after all, God gave us brains to use. Now, that's an interesting statement. Well, your best thinking brought you here. This is an example of sponsor dependency. Well, I'll do the thinking for you. All right? Anybody tells you that, run. I mean it. You will never learn to trust God until you start trusting God. And people go, oh, well, I've made such a mess out of myself, I'm not making any more decisions, I ask my sponsor. You got another drunk telling you what to do. Did you ever think about that? And you ask a drunk anything, they'll give you an answer. Well, I'm concerned about my diabetes. I think that you should eat more cantaloupe. Hello. Why would you ask a drunk medical questions? I mean it. Why would you ask him legal questions? Why would you ask him relationship questions? Jesus, you talk about the height of absurdity. I shouldn't say this. I heard a speaker who had been married like six times get up and give a relationship seminar. And I thought, I think I just fell into the Twilight Zone. What the hell is he doing? This guy is a poster child for a train wreck in relationships, and he's standing up here telling me what to do? I think I have something else to do, something much better to do. I think I'll take a nap. Okay? So remember that if you want advice from another drunk, that's what you're going to get. Okay? Now, there's some good advice you can get from drunks, and part of that has to do with what their experience is in recovery. You can get good advice there, sometimes. The truth is that depending upon another drunk to show you how to navigate your way through life is a real minefield. And it's a hell of an argument for improving your intuitive thought. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. In thinking about our day, we may face indecision. We may not be able to determine which course to take. Here we ask God for inspiration, intuitive thought, or decision. It's like pausing. It's the same thing as pausing when agitated or doubtful and asking for the right thought or action. You know, if you get stuck someplace, just back up. Sometimes I physically take a step back and I go, show me what's going on here, God. I don't get it. Show me what's going on. And I generally get some clarity, and clarity is important. We relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. We are often surprised how the right answers come after we've tried this for a while. That's against our nature. I rise to it. I want to fight. Okay? I know. It says you go in there and you say, okay, God, I don't know what's going on. Please give me inspiration, intuitive thought, or a decision here. And then we relax. Then we just sit down and wait for something to happen. And people go, you got to be nuts. Aren't you doing something about that? See what happens. You know, sometimes I go to bed at night and I'm thinking about something. I get up in the morning and I know what to do. Processed it all night, right? The answer comes. And if you're all cranked up, you're all wound up, and you're angry or resentful or whatever it is, and you're trying to come up with a solution, it's almost impossible. And the problem is that we're too far inside the problem. And then you have no perspective at all. What used to be the hunch or the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. Now they're going to talk about intuitive thought. Okay? Good stuff. What used to be this hunch or an occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. That means that you get good at this. That means you get practiced at this. Being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God is not improbable. It's not probable that we're going to be inspired at all times. See, there's things in here that I just am knocked down by. It says that we just made conscious contact with God. We're way back in the 11th step. You know, I'm asking, what did I do in 2 and 3? Okay? And now you're telling me I just made conscious contact? I don't argue with it. I just am offended by it. Being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God. It's not probable that we're going to be inspired all times. We may pay for this presumption in all sorts of absurd action and ideas. So you go chasing around your intuitive thought, and you may find out that you really stepped in the wrong direction. You know what? It's fine. Just do something else. Don't worry about it. You're just going to make some mistakes. And less as time goes on. And it's all part of the spiritual life. And if you want to learn about spiritual life, you just have to go out and practice it. And you have to. I used to get up and speak at conventions. And part of my prayer was, God, please make me an instrument of your will, even if it makes me look like a fool. Okay. Nevertheless, we will find that our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. We come to rely on it. We usually conclude this period of meditation with a prayer that we be shown all through the day what our next step is to be, that we be given whatever we need to take care of such problems we ask, especially for freedom from self-will, and are careful to make no requests for ourselves only. We may ask for ourselves, however, if others will be helped. We are careful never to pray for our own selfish ends. Many of us have wasted a lot of time doing that. It doesn't work. You can easily see why. How do you do this? You do it just like it says. Okay? That's what I do. That's why everybody's pages are broken out here. Okay? So you go, God, please show me all through the day what my next step is to be, and please give me whatever I need to take care of the problems. I ask especially for freedom from self-will. That's the prayer. And that's what you do. If circumstances warrant, we ask our wives or friends to join us in morning meditation. If we belong to a religious denomination which requires a definite morning devotion, we attend to that also. If not members of a religious body, we sometimes select and memorize a few set prayers which emphasize the principles which we have been discussing. There are many helpful books also. Suggestions about these may be obtained from one's priest, minister, or rabbi. Be quick to see where religious people are right. Make use of what they have to offer. You know, most of the people I know in AA will throw some prayers on the end of their morning 11th step. And a lot, the common ones are the third step prayer, sometimes the seventh step prayer, okay? Sometimes the fear prayer, sometimes another prayer. I've listened to suggestions about helpful books. I've read everything Emmett Fox ever wrote, I think. I've read a lot of Thomas Merton. I've read books like If You See the Buddha on the Road, Kill Him. I have read a whole variety of spiritual books. And some of them are really enlightening, and there is value in expanding your understanding of God by some things outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know how to say that in any other way. This is not the only book in the world that talks about God, but this is the one I pay attention to. Thomas Merton says some of the most wonderful things. You want to read an interesting story about somebody, read this book called The Seven Story Mountain, which is about Thomas Merton's life. And he was a Cistercian monk, Trappist. That those people are silent most of the time. And was a pretty, just an interesting book. You know, if you get to it, fine. All right. As we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. How do you do that?
Stop and pay attention.
Uh-huh. What does agitated or doubtful mean?
Just wrong.
that could be part of it. Do you know what agitated feels like? Doubtful? I don't know where to go. It says we pause. That means stop. Stop. And turn to God. Everything in this 11th step is about turning to God. What we do in the morning, what we do at night, what we do during the day. So we stop and we say, God, please give me the right thought or action. We constantly remind ourselves we're no longer running the show. Humbly saying to ourselves many times each day, thy will not my, thy will be done. We are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, worry, anger, worry, self-pity, and foolish decisions. We become more efficient. We don't tire so easily, for we are not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. Run out of energy? Take a look. It really works. This is about feeling like we're responsible for making everything happen in our lives, and it just wears us out. But if I'm saying, God, please take control of this, thy will be done. Yeah, I know. You know these electronic watches that beep every hour? I mean, they're annoying. You ever see those? I know guys that wear those just so it beeps. You know why? Because every time it beeps, they say, thy will be done. You can't get to it any other way. So it is, you know, it's almost a Pavlovian response. They just don't start drooling. They say, thy will be done. It works, it really does. We alcoholics are undisciplined, so we let God discipline us in the simple way we have just outlined. But this is not all. There is action and more action. Faith without works is dead. The next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12. I just had this conversation this week with my 16-year-old. Faith without works is dead. Do you know? Tell me about that. Straight out of the Bible, what does it mean? Yeah. What did, huh?
Action is, it takes forethought. You see a lot of people involved in activity. They make a lot of noise. They complain a lot. Lots of smoke around them, but nothing happens. Where someone who's in action, you don't hear very much about it, and they just get the job done.
Faith without works. Faith without works means believing it and doing nothing about it. It means I believe in God, but there's no manifestation of that in my life. Oh, I'm sure I'm willing to believe. But this is a program of action. It's like people who come into Alcoholics Anonymous and don't do anything. They just sit here and take up space. We had a couple of people that come into my home group one night, and they were constant slippers. And they came in there and said, well, I'm back. And I know that I'm the most important person in the room. And I said, bullshit, I'm the most important person in the room. And they said, well, you know, that's what we alcoholics do. We drink. And that's what I did. And I'm back. And I had an intuitive thought. I hate to even tell you about this. I told both of them, why the hell don't you get up and get out of here? you're coming in here and taking space in this meeting that could be used by someone who really wants to get sober, and you're coming in here running your bullshit on everybody, and you have no more intention of getting sober than the man in the moon, why the hell don't you just leave? And people go, oh, God. Here he goes again. What do you stand for? Do you have the courage of your convictions? Jesus, I mean, what'd you go through all this for? Do you think you got to run around being nice to everybody? What if their life is at stake? What if the only way they're going to hear you is if you bark at them? You going to be afraid of what other people think? If you do, they'll wander off and die. And I'm not saying go be mean to somebody or go browbeat them for the hell of it. I'm talking about if they need to hear the truth, do you have the courage to tell them? Huh? Do you? I mean, do you have any convictions at all? And if you do, are you willing to stand up for them? What is it you stand for? If you don't stand for anything, what the hell are you here for? You know, coming in here and doing this stuff is one thing, and that will bring us sobriety. But the truth is that this is not a one-way street. This just flat isn't. This is a two-way street. That means that somebody's going to save your life. Someone's coming in here, and they are going to take you by the hand and guide you through this process and save your life. And if you think it's all about you and that's as far as it has to go, you missed the whole point. Because this is about learning about recovery in no uncertain terms, which means precisely how to recover, and then going out and showing other people precisely how to recover, and having this absolutely amazing experience about watching the lights turn on. You can physically see that. You'll be sitting in a room reading this book with someone and showing them how to follow the directions, and you will virtually see the lights turn on. You don't want to miss that. That is an incredible, amazing experience. And it probably saves their lives. All right. What are we doing? So let's talk about that 12. You have any questions about 11? I mean, well, we talked about that. Just read it and do it. Okay, that's what most people do. That's why the book wears out there. So we're going to talk about step 12. And that's not only about helping others. That's about what are you going to do? How are you going to live? Everyone's intuitive, even the people coming in the door. I mean, people aren't so messed up by alcohol that they aren't intuitive. And they'll come in there and they'll look around and they'll make a decision. And if they want recovery, they're going to move towards the people with recovery. And if they want to try and do what they were doing on the outside after they come in, they'll find people like that in AA. If you have a clear, precise, and unafraid message, you aren't going to attract people who don't want recovery. They'll run away from you as fast as they can go. Okay? That's the way it is. Has to do with their intent. So, here's what I do. If I see someone suffering from untreated alcoholism, I will, the first thing I will do is I'll say, you and I need to talk. If they ask me for help, you and I need to talk. It's going to take about 30 minutes. Do you have the time now? And if they say yes, we move into the next thing. And the next thing is I sit down with them and I explain all 12 steps. Here's what I'm going to ask you to do. And I describe each step and everything they have to do in it, and it takes it about 30 minutes. Okay? Step one, we had to concede to our innermost selves we're alcoholics. It's the first step in recovery. The delusion that we're like other people who presently maybe has to be smashed. That means you have to understand in your deepest self that you are alcoholic and you're not like other people and you aren't ever going to be. Step two, are you even willing to believe? Is there anything in you that will grasp the idea that there may be a God? And if you are you willing to believe that He is? Three is about this, four is about this, five is about this, six is about this. Go through the whole process. Talk about all 12 steps. What do you do that for? Because you don't want to get somebody going through the steps, coming back and saying, you never told me about that. And so what I tell them is, this is a description of everything that I am going to ask you to do. And the only way I'm going to do this is if you agree to do all of it. That means you aren't going to do one and two and blow out of here. That means that you know everything that you're going to have to do and you agree to do it and you agree to start from the very beginning and get to the end. Some of them aren't going to do that, but they got to agree to do it. And if they do that, the next thing I have to do is I have to know if they're an alcoholic. One of the things you hear around a lot of AA meetings is you can't tell anybody else they're alcoholic. Like hell you can't. It tells me in the book that I have to determine whether I believe this person's an alcoholic. Is this some kind of Looney Tune? What? They went to a meeting in Los Angeles. Guy was in there. And he says, I'm a cocaine addict. And I come to this meeting because it's the only place that I can find recovery. And so what I'm doing is I'm coming to this meeting and calling myself an alcoholic, even though I'm a cocaine addict, because I don't know where else to go, and what's the matter with that? Do you know what the matter with that is? You can't have a spiritual experience based on a lie. And we did in my home group? We had a whole bunch of NA people come over and we took them through the steps. We did. I got tired of them coming to our meeting calling themselves alcoholics. I mean, I like them. I just couldn't figure out what the hell they were up to. So they come over there and, some junkie... I mean, one of them is a good friend of mine. This junkie comes over there, and he's in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting going, I'm so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic, and he's in there calling an alcoholic, and I go, you can't do that. And he said, why not? And I said, it won't work for you. It's a lie. And he said, I don't know what else to do. And I said, well, I know what else to do. Bring all your friends over here who really want to change the face of the organization that you're in to provide you with a solution, and we'll show you how to do it. So we had the NA people came in and we taught them how to work steps. Okay. Hey. Is that a closed meeting?
No, it's
open. Oh, okay. Well, they can. Yes. different problem. Yes. So it's my responsibility to determine whether these people are alcoholics or not, and if I don't think they're drunk, I won't work with them. What would be the point? I don't know. Okay? Does that sound harsh? I don't know how to deal with gambling, and I don't know how to deal with obsessive eating, and I don't know how to deal with intravenous drug use, and I don't know how to deal with overzealous emotions. I don't know how to deal with compulsive sexual addicts. I don't know how to deal with any of those people. I know about drunks, okay? And so, you know, I'm just kidding myself if I'm trying to do anything else. So, I show them what the 12 steps are. Then I determine whether they're alcoholic. And then I get them engaged in the process. Then I get them to come over. We start to forward to the first edition. We do everything it says to do. I generally do it with them. And we go through the book. It takes about 6 months. I mean, for an hour, hour and a half, once a week, that's about how long it takes. And they have lots of questions if they're interested, okay? And that's what I do. I tell them that if I help them, their responsibility is to help somebody else. And the reason why this fellowship continues to grow after all these years is because of precisely that. You will never know how scary carrying an incomplete message is until you have a complete message. So, I'll tell you something funny about this. Continue to speak of alcoholism as an illness, a fatal malady. And I thought, if I'm working with somebody and I'm telling them they're going to die, what's the point there? And I was looking at it and I thought, I don't think that's right. But that's the instruction, see? So I'm sitting there with a new person and I'm doing just what it says. I'm saying, you got a fatal disease, pal. And they're going, I do. And you say, you know, it's progressive. I mean, you'll go nuts first, but then you'll die. And they'll say, that's awful. I don't, you know, isn't there any hope? No, it's fatal. And I'm sitting there doing that going, what a nasty thing to do, right? And then all of a sudden, what happens? And here's why you do that. All of a sudden, they're looking at you and they're going, yeah, well, why aren't you dead? This is no joke. I did this. Then why aren't you dead? And they'll all come to it. And you go, because I have a solution. And then you got them. You see that? Try it. This is a fatal malady. And you're sitting there telling them they're going to die, and that's what they come up with. And it's the right thing to come up with. And then you say, I have a solution. But it takes a lot of work, and you may not want to do it. And they go, well, tell me what it is. And you go, okay. And then you tell them about the 12 steps. And you go, you're probably not willing to do that, right? They go, yes, I am. And you go, but it's a lot of spiritual stuff. And they go, I'm spiritual, right? Go talk about spiritual stuff. So everybody wants to talk about that. It's amazing. I mean, even non-alcoholics. They say, so what is it that you do all the time when you're doing this? And you go, well, it's a sort of a spiritual adventure that I'm on. And they go, oh, I love talking about spiritual stuff. What is it? People have a real interest in that. It talks about people with religious denominations or from religious denominations that may know a lot more about religion than you do. I mean, I've sponsored priests, I've sponsored ministers, I've sponsored all kinds of people who are in the clergy. And they'd say, so this is about God? And you go, uh-huh. And they go, well, you know, I have a doctorate in theology. And you go, that's wonderful. And they'll say, but I'm highly trained in those areas. And your answer is, well, it didn't seem to work for you. So everything you know really was to no avail. Maybe we ought to take another look. Okay? You don't have to step back from anybody here. What we do works if they do it. Don't be a bank. Don't be a lawyer. Don't be a doctor. Be a guide. I had a guy I was sponsoring that I went to see him, and he'd just been kicked out of his apartment, and all his furniture was on the front lawn of this apartment building. And he looked at me and he said, what are you going to do? You know what I told him? I'm going to watch and see what God does. And God did something. I've had the occasion on a couple of times where people came into Alcoholics Anonymous, went through the steps, found freedom, and chose not to have it. I mean, that's hard to believe. Now, the last one that did that, it took him about 6 months to start drinking again after he started trying. And I asked him why he did that. And he said, reality is just too oppressive to me. And I'd rather either be dead or living somewhere else. And so the only place I can get somewhere else, the only way I know how to get somewhere else is to drink. So I'm going to drink. And you know what? That was a rational decision on his part. And I hate to see him go, and he was a nice guy, and he didn't last very long, and that was the way that worked. Alcoholism is a nasty, dirty disease that kills people every day, and you'll watch it if you got your eyes open. And we have the power to help others. You know, this book never says we have the power to help ourselves. Not anywhere. It says I've been given the power to help others. But when it talks about power, the proper use of power is not to use it. Now that sounds silly. It's to help others. But see, if you get power in these programs, in this program, people get all caught up in having this power, and they want to go out and use it and see what its extremities are. And so they'll go out and go, well, maybe I can use this power to make some extra money by taking it away from somebody else. Or maybe I can take this power and I can influence this lady to spend some time with me. Or maybe I can use this power to get me position and more power. A nice idea, it just doesn't work, okay, because it isn't ours. So, you know, the proper use of power is not to use it or to use it to help others, and that's the end of it. And power can be really infatuating. It's like a siren song. The longer you're sober and the closer you get to God, the more power you will experience. And the more power you have, the more infatuating it becomes. And it's absolutely imperative that we understand that it is not ours. and that if we try and usurp that power, we'll either drink or die. Okay. Job or no job, wife or no wife, we simply do not stop drinking so long as we place dependence upon other people ahead of dependence upon God. When you go sponsor people, the first thing you tell them is, do not become dependent upon me under any circumstances. Your dependence and your reliance should be placed squarely upon God and no one else. If you want to talk, I'll talk to you. But I am not your problem-solving device. I am your guide through this process. Do not set yourself up as some sort of object of dependency for the people that you work with. You're going to kill them. Yeah, that's true. So what you do is you just keep beating it in their head about place your dependency squarely upon God. So you know how to do that? Here's how you do that. It's a trick that was played on me, and it took me 3 years to figure it out. So you guys, I'll tell you about it right up ahead of time. I would go to my sponsor, and I'd go, I can't tell you how much trouble I'm in. And he'd go, what's going on? And I'd go, da-da-da-da-da. This is going on. And he'd say, no kidding. And then we'd talk about it. And I'd say, I don't know what to do. And then we'd talk about it some more. And then I'd tell him, but I just don't know what to do. And then we'd talk about it some more. And we'd go through this long-winded bullshit conversation. And then in the end of it, he would say, why don't you pray about it and do what you think? And I'd go, good advice. And I'd pray about it and do what I thought. And I'd call him back a week later and I'd say, Jesus, this is going on. I am really upset. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. We'd have this long-winded conversation. At the end of that conversation, he would say, okay, well, why don't you pray about it and do what you think? And so I'd go, okay, good idea. And then I'd go do that. And then I'd go through it again. You know that I did that for 3 years before I figured out what he was doing? That's how dense I am. You know what he was doing? Teaching me to place my reliance upon God. And he said, I'll talk to you, but don't ask me questions. Okay? And he could have given me advice like most other alcoholics will give you at the drop of a hat. But he'd say, pray about it and do what you think. I don't know. You know, that's what I tell people today. Why don't you pray about it? And now it's a joke around my home group. You ask Bob what to do, that's what you get. You don't even have to ask. Don't even call. That's where it's going. Okay? Burn into the consciousness of every man that he can get well regardless of anyone. The only condition is that he trusts God and clean house. Everyone in here can get well regardless of anyone. The only requirement, the only